Chapter 41, Tuesday, January 7th through Wednesday, January 15th, 1777. It is not in the power of the smiles or frowns of Her Majesty to affect me either by conferring pleasure or giving pain. I was wholly incapable of taking the place she seemed to assign me when I was presented to her. I suppose she assented to the assertions that there were no people who had so much impudence as the Americans, for there was not any people bred even at courts who had so much confidence as the Americans. This was because they did not tremble, cringe, and fear in the presence of majesty. Nabby Adams, daughter of Abigail and John Adams, on meeting Queen Charlotte of England. When Madam woke the next morn, her first command was for hot scones. Her second was that the seamstress must be fetched immediately. The British commandant was throwing a ball in honor of Queen Charlotte's birthday in 10 days' time. Madam required a new gown for such an occasion, perhaps two. I learnt of all of this when I returned from the market with a fresh killed chicken. Hannah, who had taken over the boss lady job from Sarah after the baby was born, was preparing a cherry pie. Mary sat by the window, mending one of Madam's skirts. The notion of a ball for a queen confuddled me. "That's a long voyage for a celebration," I said. Hannah laughed. "No, you ninny. The queen isn't coming. How could she? She's got 10 children to take care of, plus all them castles."
11, added Mary. "She popped out a new one last spring.
Even though the queen can't come, the officers always hold a ball in her honor," Hannah said as she rolled out the pie dough. "Gives them a good excuse to eat too much, drink too much, and make proper fools of themselves whilst dancing."
I pulled out the feather bag and a basin.
"And Madame Lockton is attending?"
"The colonel will be her escort." Mary bit her thread in two. "All the rich folks will be there." I ripped a handful of feathers from the chicken and stuffed them in the bag. "Does Madam require anything of us?"
"Not yet," Hannah said, carefully laying the dough in the pie plate. "That will change, no doubt."
"I seen the queen herself, you know," Mary said, squinting at her stitches.
"With your own eyes?" asked Hannah.
"I don't believe you."
"Well, I seen her carriage and she was in it. The backside of the carriage, mine, actually the backside of the troops guarding the backside of the carriage, but I saw the wheels bent down to do it."
She threaded another needle.
"Bet you don't know her name."
"Her Majesty," said Hannah.
"Proves you're not a Londoner," Mary said. "Her proper name is Her Majesty Queen Charlotte of Great Britain, Duchess Sophia Charlotte of Mecklenburg-Strelitz."
"How do you remember all them names when you can't remember from one minute to the next how much salt goes into the biscuits?" asked Hannah.
"Biscuits are not as important as the queen. I practiced her name from the time I was a girl, case the day ever come when she saw me on the street and I could call out her entire gracious name. If I did that, her carriage would stop and she'd make me a lady-in-waiting on account of my good manners."
There was a moment of silence while the two women considered this,
then a loud outburst as they near fell over themselves in laughter. After dinner, Lady Seymour had a frightful seizure of the apoplexy. Looked just like one of Ruth's fits, except not with so much shaking. She fell into a sleep so deep I thought she was stone dead. But every so often, she'd take a breath, and once she opened her eyes. When she woke the next morning, she could not speak nor move her legs. Dr. DeStooge arrived and bled her and stuck pins in her limbs and gave her a bitter tea. In truth, there was nothing could make her better. I was told to tend her again, as I had right after the fire. I fed her and held the teacup to her lips and wiped her chin when she dribbled and helped her with the chamber pot business. This last was most distressing for her, and she cried. Then I wiped the tears from her face.
I heard Madam ask the doctor plain when the old lady would die.
The doctor could not answer her.
I figured Madam wanted Lady Seymour to die as soon as possible, but not before the Queen's ball. If the house was in mourning, it wouldn't be proper for Madam to dance with the Admiral and make merry. A week before the ball, Madam ordered that Lady Seymour be moved to the parlor bedchamber downstairs so she could reclaim the largest bedchamber for herself. After two privates had carried the lady down and she was propped up on her pillow so she could look out the window, Madam called me upstairs.
"I want this room aired and the linens boiled, girl. It smells of decay in here."
The work of the day was simple and heavy. Strip the bed,
haul down the linens for to wash, clean out the hearth, open the windows and wash them inside and out, take the rugs down and beat them in the yard, sweep and mop the floor, take the rugs back in, close the windows, and give all the wood a polish. When the chamber was clean, Madam told me to open the windows again and let them stand open all afternoon to make sure there was no lingering pestilence in the air. I did as I was told. The doctor came right before supper and gave Lady Seymour a potion that would make the night pass quickly for her. When she was ready for bed, Madam called for me to bring up a warming pan filled with coals and run it between the sheets because they were chilled and still a wee bit damp. I did what she asked, then returned to the kitchen, dumped the coals in the hearth, and crept under my own blanket. She called for me again. The sheets were still too cold for her liking. I refilled the warming pan, carried it up the stairs, and warmed her bed. Then I stoked the fire in her hearth before returning down the stairs. The third time she called for me, I was sore tempted to dump the glowing coals onto her bed, let it blaze, and ask if that was warm enough. But I did not. I performed the task she gave me, and when she called a quarter hour later, I did it again. The sun rose bright the next day, catching in the icicles that hung from the eaves and jumping off the snow like a mirror. The linens pegged out on the line were froze stiff as wood and covered in a lacework of ice. The clouds scuttled away and the sun blazed, turning the yard into a garden of jewels. Ruth would love this. If we were free and at home in Rhode Island, and these were our sheets and our laundry lines and our snow, she'd dance like an angel. The pictures in my brain pan caught me by surprise. I could not clear them away. She'd clap her hands at the sight of the frozen laundry. She'd twirl in the spinning swirls of snow that lifted in the breeze. She'd plunge her hands into the bushes to pluck off the diamonds. She would do all these things and laugh and... The wind tossed a handful of snow in my face and washed it all away. Ruth would not see this. Never. I dried my face. Why was I thinking of Ruth? I'd worked hard to pack her away from my mind, along with the thoughts of Mama and Papa and the life Ruth and I were promised. Didn't help to ponder things that were forever gone. It only made her body restless and fill up with bees all wanting to sting something. I kicked at the new snow. It rose up, a sparkling diamond breeze fit for a queen. 'Twas Lady Seymour who did it. Her with her begging forgiveness for not buying me and telling me I'd have been a good slave for her. Her with her wet eyes and skeleton hands. Did she never think about setting me free? That would be a fine question to ask. 'Course there was no sense to asking it because her mouth didn't work anymore. I carried the big laundry basket out to the sheets. I'd have to hang them in the kitchen else they wouldn't dry till spring. Another picture hung itself in my mind. The poetry book in the stationer's shop. The one I'd been afraid to read. Miss Phyllis Wheatley went free when her master released her. 'Twas on account of her fame, Mama said. Master Wheatley looked the fool for keeping a poetical genius enslaved in his household. I'd heard of other slaves who bought their freedom. Folks who were given their Sunday afternoons to work for themselves, who saved their pennies and farthings for years and years until they had piled up the 150 or 200 pounds to buy their body and soul from their master. If I had Sunday afternoons free, I'd figure a way to earn my pennies. I could sew or hire out to scrub stables. I'd even clean the cells of the bridewell, like that guard asked. I took a long stick from the pile of kindling wood. It would never happen. Madam would not allow it. She was set on keeping my arms and legs dancing to her tune and my soul bound in her chains. I pulled the stick back and cracked it against the side of the frozen bed linen. The ice shattered and fell to the ground, tinkling like pieces of fallen stars.